Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. And we're going to do some emails. We're going to do some interesting stories. I'm going to just talk a bit at the top of the hour. And the first thing I want to talk about is some good news. The country is making progress. We just got word from the chief that we can start taking our masks outside. If we're fully vaccinated, we can actually have our masks out in our house with another fully vaccinated couple. And that news came out a few weeks ago, and I have been enjoying my newfound freedom. I haven't felt this freed since I got my first cell phone and no longer had to get off of Highway 1 whenever my beeper went off and it was the hospital number. That kept me on the leash, but it gave me a longer leash, and I loved it. Now, in the masking announcement that Biden made is a little more lenient than the actual California Department of Public Health. So go to the cdph.ca.gov site if you're looking for the details here. But there are a few more restrictions for us Californians, which I want to encourage you to follow. And why do I say that? Well, because this is like the year 1943, and World War II didn't end in 1943 just because we won a few battles. And make no mistake about this. This is another war to preserve our way of life, and we can still lose it. I'm worried about complacency. I'm worried about us being able to keep up our discipline, and I include myself in that. I'm worried about people who still feel unsure if they can trust the COVID vaccines that are out there available to them. And I'm worried about the media, because the media has got a clear case of the oh my gods and a clear case of the whatabouts. What about the variants? What about, should we wait to get the vaccine until there's a new vaccine? What about the blood clots? Should we worry about getting a blood clot in our brain? What about the vaccine altering my DNA? Hey, but hon, that's just not a thing, okay? What about the transmitter from Bill Gates being included in the vaccine? Yeah, that's not a thing either. What about, well, you fill in the blank, okay? Because there's a gazillion of them out there. We're going to hit some of the things that patients have said to me in a moment. But before that, I've got a what about coming along. Remember what I just said about complacency? Well, what about India? This is what complacency looks like, friends. It looks like declaring victory prematurely. Let's not go there. Let's just not. Speaking of India, guess what? People are dying in India, but people are getting on airplanes and coming to the United States and ending up in hospitals in the United States. So we need to be vaccinated. You do. You do, because the vaccine helps against the vaccines, especially the Moderna and the Pfizer, help against the variant that is currently burning India down. So yeah, you want to be vaccinated. I have it on good authority from the public health department that a number of people are sitting in intensive care units in Santa Clara County who got off the airplane from India very, very sick recently. So don't kid yourself. This war is not even close to over. What's your risk of dying of COVID? Well, based on the data going through August of 2020, it's about 10 in 1,000 people who die of COVID. And yes, that's usually people who are older than 65. Let's take a look at some numbers. I want to share these with you, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to post these. This is coming from a scientific article. It's solid data. It's got the CDC imprimatur on it, and they're trying to get your attention with this. So let me explain what the table looks like. You're looking at ages, and everything is being benchmarked or compared to the 15 to 17 years old risk of dying. Okay, risk of hospitalization and risk of getting it. Let's talk about 18 through 29 compared to those 5 to 17 year olds. They've got a double the rate of getting it, 6 times the rate of hospitalization, and 10 times the rate of dying. What if we jump to the 40 to 49-year-olds? Well, they've got a 130 times greater risk of death and a 15 times greater risk of hospitalization. Now, if you think about that for a moment, if you're over 40, your chances of getting bad COVID are really good. And this is the old COVID, the pre-variant COVID. So cases are still just twice as much from the reference group, but severe cases, 15 times as much, and death, 130 times as much. Kids don't die from this. 40-year-olds? Yeah, some of them. What if you're 65 years old? That's our most vaccinated group for a reason, right? I said 130 times. Well, try 10 times that, 1,300 times. People take a look at those numbers. Please, take a look at those numbers. And if you're just in your 30s and you think you're cool, well, your risk of death compared to the high school kids is 45 times greater. Now, sure, that's nothing compared to, you know, 1,300 times greater, but it's still a substantial number of 30-year-olds who are dying of this disease. You're not safe. By the way, that's the group that's getting out there. You know, they're the group that pretty much either has to work or has, let's just say, hormonal drives that cause them to want to associate with others. And I don't blame anybody for their behavior. I do blame them for willful ignorance, and I want to caution you against complacency because this is really not the moment to be selfish. Now, I said selfish. I'm going to double down on social responsibility here. And this goes back to what I was saying about the masks, okay? You don't know how contagious you are unless you did a DNA test or you've been vaccinated. If you've been vaccinated, it's really unlikely that you're going to transmit this or the variants. We've done some studies and the variants last in the nose of the vaccinated people about 24 hours as opposed to 10 days in unvaccinated people. So there's a lot less opportunity to transmit this to other people. I mean, I could just think of so many behaviors that we would absolutely not countenance. Let's see. How about driving a car with no brakes because you're planning on coasting to a halt? You know, you don't know what you might do to somebody else. And I think you'd need to look at that and say, firing a bullet into the air, the bullet turns around and comes down. And what if it hits somebody in the head? Well, you don't fire bullets into the air. But effectively, walking around without a mask, unvaccinated, yeah, maybe you forge a vaccine card. I don't know if we're going to get vaccine passports, but certainly there'll be people who try to game that. I just want to emphasize how important it is that we actually behave like the people of the quote-unquote greatest generation behaved, which is they step up to the plate and they do what they need to do to help their country fight an existential threat. And, you know, I want to put on my red, white, and blue suit, point at you and say, this means you. I'm going to tell you one story. That's a story of a patient the other day who is in her 70s, but she's, you know, isolated and she's been good. And I asked her, well, when did you get your vaccine? And she said, oh, no, I haven't had it yet. I'm worried about the vaccine. I asked her, well, what worries you about it? You know, tell me, maybe I can help you feel better about getting it. And she said, well, I haven't had a vaccine since I had the hepatitis B vaccine because I had an allergic reaction to that. I went home and I started to get throat swelling and I started to get hives and I went to the emergency room and they gave me epinephrine. And, you know, I'm scared of vaccines. I'm afraid I might be allergic to it. Do you know what's in the hepatitis B vaccine? And she said, well, they told me it was probably the thimerosal that I reacted to. And by the way, this is the most common thing that's in vaccines that people react to. It isn't in vaccines, new vaccines anymore. It's used as a preservative. It's a very small amount of a mercury compound. And you can imagine what the anti-vaxxers have done with that. And Yeah, for some people, maybe it's a problem, but it's not very common. There is none of it in any of the COVID-19 vaccines. So I tried to explain that to her, but she said, well, maybe I'll be allergic to one of the other things. We're not seeing that. We're taking all those precautions. We're waiting and making people hang around. We're waiting for that reaction. That's part of the protocol. And, you know, it's just not happening. We've had a few people faint, but then people faint when they get vaccines. But no hives, no wheezing, no need for the epinephrine. It's right there, but we haven't needed it. I think it's pretty good to say that we probably aren't going to be needing it. But that doesn't mean you don't keep the epi on hand whenever you get an allergy shot or give a vaccine for that matter, because you never know and you don't want to be caught with your pants down the first time it happens. It's not a sign that we're worried. It's a sign that we're careful and that we care about you and we're prepared for anything that happens. It shouldn't be taken as a sign of doubt. I don't know if I made a dent or I don't know if I make a dent right here with whoever's listening to me, but I definitely made a dent with this listener. And so I'm going to read her fairly long email. I think it's a very good one. It's sort of on the topic because this is related to the April 12th show where I had a conversation with a caller. So let's go to Sybil in Soquel's email. Dear Dr. Dawn, in the April 12th show, I was taken aback at what had been put out there, including the flippant remark of caller Tim from Soquel, a vaccine hesitant. After you urged him to do the socially responsible thing and get the vaccine, he stated that he was doing the socially responsible thing by doing the right thing with his diet and lifestyle. You then mentioned that you had many people in your practice that had cancer and felt it was unfair because they were doing all the right things by being a vegan, actually said vegetarian or vegan, and exercising. So I want to just correct the quotation. That made it really sound like a lot of people who are vegan are getting cancer. I know that was not your intention, but it came across that way. It distorts the big picture and the facts. Caller Tim then flippantly interrupted with, well, they shouldn't be vegans. And you tried to stop him, and thank you for that. The facts are that a huge majority of vegans do live longer. All the people who live in the so-called blue zones, these are places on this earth where people live the longest, eat very little or no meat, or eat meat as a condiment, in other words, in small amounts. They definitely do not follow the latest paleo diet craze. In fact, just the opposite. Take the one blue zone in the U.S., the people of Loma Linda, California, where people live the longest in the U.S. They are vegans because of their Seventh-day Adventist religion that encourages a vegan diet. So overall, vegans do live longer and healthier. And I want to stop for a moment and agree with that statement. The vegan diet is not exposing you to many things that can make you die sooner. It is a limited diet, but it is probably the healthiest diet for many individuals. I do have some reservations in certain circumstances, but I'm not going to get into that tonight. COVID-19. Okay, every last epidemic and pandemic originated in animals. COVID-19 originated in China in bats or pangolins or other wild animals where it jumped from a species to humans. This can happen here in the U.S. or anywhere else on the planet. We are being given a wake-up call, but are we listening? So far, I haven't seen or heard it. Very little has been talked about in the media. I've only heard one doctor talking about this, Dr. Stanley Perelman, microbiologist. If we fail to learn a lesson here, we risk to repeat the mistake. Our miserable treatment of factory farm animals, our failed humane animal husbandry has gotten us into this mess. If we are willing to change, the next 10 times deadlier pandemic is right around the corner. Our current meat industry is a ticking time bomb. Okay, so first of all, I want to address that I had no intentions of saying that vegans get cancer more than other people. What I did mean to say, and I will still say it again, because I do mean it, vegans do get cancer. The worst they may be is somewhat complacent about their cancer risk. Yes, they're safer than the average person, but they're not safe. And so don't not get your mammogram, don't not get your cancer screening tests for colon cancer because you're a vegan and you think that makes you bulletproof. It doesn't. There are a lot of unavoidable carcinogens out there. Let's see. Cosmic rays, ultraviolet radiation, mold toxins, plastics, which are everywhere and unavoidable. And you could be living in a cave in Antarctica. Good luck with that. But you'd still be exposed to plastics. We'll come to that later. I also want to point out, Sybil, with all due respect, that you made a factual error there. It is not true that every last epidemic and pandemic originated in animals. There are plenty of severe pandemics. I'll give you two that you will know about. One of them is polio, okay? There is no animal host for polio. If you work really hard in a laboratory, you might be able to infect a monkey, but they are not natural hosts or reservoirs for this disease. This is well and truly a human-exclusive virus. And then there's smallpox. Smallpox also does not infect anything but humans. And that's a scourge that has had plenty of time to kill plenty of people in waves for literally, you know, millennia that we know about. It was out there in ancient Egypt. But we actually won the battle against smallpox. And we won it with a combination of vaccination and quarantine. We got it. We got rid of a disease. And we got rid of a disease that was an epidemic and a pandemic. So just saying, go us. And also, you know what? There are human-only diseases that are not caused by your diet or eating meat or, you know, the meat industry. I also want to point out to everyone that global climate change is so much more dangerous than a pandemic. And taking one of Sybil's points, there's a win-win. If we reduce our farming practices and modify our diet to use meat as a condiment at the most, we will benefit enormously and we will help reduce the carbon burden on the planet and possibly be able to continue to keep our coastal cities, which would be nice because, you know, that's where a lot of economic activity is. So I want to just close because really, I'm not trying to make vegans mad here. I'd actually like to be a vegan someday. I've been working up to it, reducing my meat consumption across the board, but it's not easy. And as a busy professional who has sometimes just is traveling, particularly is quite challenging, it's hard to do. It's hard to do and still eat a healthy diet. I don't want to be a vegetarian for many, many reasons, but there's a lot of diabetes in my family, and I refuse to eat tons and tons of readily available carbs. So good luck finding a snack at 7-Eleven that doesn't involve animal products. I'm sorry, but it's true. Also, I want to point out, for people who are poor, economically disadvantaged, or living in food deserts, veganism isn't even a possibility. You know, we need to also understand where our privilege lies. And speaking as a physician, a healthy vegan diet does require a substantial budget. It's, you know, it's very, very hard to grow all of your own food. And I don't know too many vegans that talk to me about their veganism who produce their own food. So I think we need to be kind to each other and respectful. And I hope that this has been both of those in a discussion of what I think is a set of very important issues. So let's go to Mary Ann in Felton's email. And Mary Ann wants to talk about post-essential thrombocytopenia myelofibrosis. Hello, Dr. Dawn. I'm so happy to listen to your wonderful information about life. You have helped me in so many things in my life when you were on the radio before K-Squid and taking care of my mother-in-law for 7 years with dementia until she passed away in 2016. We had so much fun and adventures having her live with us. I call that time the fun with Velma years. Ah, now I know who you are. I am now asking about my older sister, who has a type of myeloproliferative neoplasm called post-essential thrombocytopenia myelofibrosis. She had ET, essential thrombocytopenia, for many, many, many years. Now she has ET, I'm going to just say ET MF because I can't keep pronouncing this correctly. I am 63 and she is 67. We have two older sisters and one younger sister of 59. I do not totally understand this disease, but I told her I would help if I can. What is this disease? How do you get it? And what can be done to prevent dying from it instead of dying of old age? Thank you for whatever you can tell me. I love her a lot and want to keep her around for more adventures. She lives in Nashville, Tennessee. Okay, so Marianne, let's start out with defining our terms. And I really want to start with essential thrombocytopenia, because that's where your sister started. So what does essential mean? It's like, what, huh? It's a medical term. And just like legal terms, when you hear a medical term, it may or may not mean what it means in regular English. And this is a great example of one that really doesn't mean anything like normal English. So essential means pretty much, essential hypertension means we have no idea what your risk factors are. You just got this disease and we call it hypertension. Most hypertension is essential hypertension. There are a few people who have hereditary versions or they have hypertension as a secondary complication of, let's say, kidney disease, or let's say some other medical issue that triggers the hypertension. In this situation, however, essential hypertension, we almost don't even bother to say essential because it's presumed, but that is in fact the name of hypertension for the most part. Essential thrombocytopenia means you have low platelets and your bone marrow is not making enough of them. And we don't know why. Now we do, but when it was named, it was just, well, people get this. It's thrombocytopenia, which is low platelets. We don't know why they have it. They get it. And the condition has a natural history. That's where the post comes in. Post-essential thrombocytemia myelofibrosis is scar tissue in the bone marrow. So if we look into the bone marrow of your sister, let's say 10 years ago, what we would have seen, that there weren't as many platelet-producing megakaryocytes as there should have been, that they were not producing as many platelets. They were thin on the ground at a rate that we wouldn't expect. If we were to look now in your sister's bone marrow, we would see fibrosis, in other words, scar tissue. We would see that the bone marrow has been damaged for so long that now it's being replaced with scar, which of course aggravates the situation. There are other myeloproliferative neoplasms, and myeloproliferative means the bone marrow is growing, but it's not producing the stuff we want. So we have things like polycythemia vera, which is where you overproduce red blood cells until you don't. And then we have other types of myeloproliferative disorders. And we're going to stick with yours and your sister's rather. But typically what we see once you get fibrosis is we start to see bone marrow failure, and we start to see things like anemia, and we start to see lower white counts, and we start to see immature cells. And in fact, one of the signs of myelofibrosis is that you start to see bigger cells. You start to see bigger red cells, and these bigger red cells aren't because the person's B12 deficient. It's because they're being kicked out of the bone marrow early. It's almost like the stem cells that make the red blood cells are saying, you know, get out of here quick because it's a toxic environment. But anyway, the cells haven't completely matured. So if we see that, we check our B12 level, we check our folate, no problems there. We'll often monitor that. And if the cells are getting bigger, that's called megalocythemia. If we start to see that, then we're going to get a bone marrow biopsy and look for this paucity of cells. So it's a bone marrow dysfunction. They're all bone marrow dysfunctions, and they kind of evolve a little differently in person to person. But eventually, the anemia can cause the spleen to enlarge. And what's up with that? Well, the bone marrow isn't making red blood cells, but you have stem cells in your spleen that that can actually produce red blood cells. So the spleen says, all right, ride to the rescue, I'll start making red blood cells. But then the spleen starts growing, and having an enlarged spleen creates problems all by itself. There's a really broad range of how long it takes to get from your first diagnosis of essential thrombocytopenia to this, but basically, thrombocythemia, excuse me, but basically up to 20 years. So like you said, years and years and years and years, and your sister's pretty typical. The older you are, the more likely it is to progress, and the more immature white cells you have, the more likely it is to actually move to leukemia. This was a study of 755 people, similar situations, and they were measured between 1984 and 2013. Some of them were followed for a very long time, 3,500 patient years, and 11% of the patients progressed to leukemia. So in terms of what can be done here, your sister may require transfusions or platelet plaques to keep her in a situation where she has her blood will clot and she'll be able to fight infections. People can survive for a very long time with support. Just to talk about some of the issues here, what's going on here? Why does this happen? Well, it happens because of mutations, but the mutations happen in the living individual. People will show up with a JAK2 gene. This is something that is present in about a little over half of the people who go on to develop this, but the presence of this gene is in the bone marrow. All right, so I just want to emphasize that you don't necessarily have to feel like you and your sisters are at increased risk here. Let's talk to Michael in Aromas.
Hi, Dawn. It's Michael.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Ton ami qui parle français en Aromas maintenant?
Non, pas maintenant. Nous sommes sur les radios américaines.
Yes, just to let you know which Michael you're talking to.
Well, it's good to hear your voice in whatever language. What can we do?
You know, I had, at the beginning of the month, an altercation on my bicycle with a car down near the Swiss Street courtyard.
I can guess who won.
Yes, and I was taken to the hospital, where then I was then airlifted to Stanford. I was unconscious there for 4 days. I was conscious there for 5 days, then returned to a rehab facility here in Santa Cruz, which I escaped after 1 day because I couldn't take it there. So I've been back home in Aroma since then, dealing with neurologists and physiologists and ophthalmologists and all kinds of people. Well, and then I got a call today from I talked to a neurosurgeon yesterday, and I got a call from her office today that said, we suggest that you be taking one St. Joseph's baby aspirin per day. And I said, okay, I will consider that. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to call Dawn and ask her what she thinks of thinning my blood with one baby aspirin per day.
Well, okay. First of all, I have a couple of questions about your head injury before I could answer. And I'm guessing, but I do need to confirm, that there was no evidence for any bleeding intracranially. So I'm sure you had scans. Is that correct?
I'm unsure how to answer that.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead. I'm going to predicate my response to your question then on the basis of the fact that you probably did not have any intracranial bleeding. Remind me of your age, Michael, because that I do not have in my memory banks.
I'm 74 next month.
Okay, 74. And you've got no cardiovascular disease, right?
No.
Okay. And strong family history of heart attacks in male or female relatives in their 50s?
I was adopted at birth, so I don't have that information.
You don't. Okay. So, first of all, this reminds me of a bumper sticker I saw, which went along the lines of, ask your doctor if taking medical advice from the internet is right for you. And this is kind of a situation like, ask the neurosurgeon if cardiovascular advice is good for you. There is a possibility that they told you to do this because you have some calcium in your carotid arteries. Without knowing the results of the scan, and understanding neurologists and medical CYA and our litigious medical culture, my guess is you do, and they were just covering their butt, telling you to do this because it does reduce your risk of a stroke. Without seeing your medical records, the first question I would have is, okay, an avid bicycler, how often, you know, does he race? Does he mountain bike? Is he likely to fall down, go boom? Because I'm sure you had a helmet on with your little contretemps with the car, and yet you were knocked out for 4 days. So if you'd been taking an aspirin, certainly the risk that you would have had an intracranial bleed would be greater. But I'm sure you've been riding your bicycle for many years, and this is probably the first really bad accident you've had. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I always wonder about giving blood thinners to people who are at risk for trauma. And so that's part of the thing on my mind. So it's a risk-benefit calculation, rather like what I was talking about at the top of the hour. What's your risk of dying from COVID versus what's your risk of dying from the vaccine? Well, in this case, we're talking about your risk of having an intracranial bleed from a subsequent accident, not from this one, and the benefit of preventing a stroke. And you really have to risk calculate your stroke risk, which I can't do. I would advise you to have your primary care doctor, I'm sure you have one, get a ultrasound duplex Doppler, which would be a test of looking at the carotid arteries and seeing if you've got any plaque, and if you've got like a 10% plaque or a 30% or a 70%. When you get to about 70%, the risk of stroke is high enough that we definitely want you on a baby aspirin. And that would be kind of malpractice not to tell you baby aspirin at that moment. So, you know, it's a risk-benefit calculus that I cannot do for you, but I can tell you how to do it for yourself. In the meantime, as you recover from your head injury, how are you doing? Are you cognitively back? Your French is obviously back, so that's good. But are you feeling like you're back, or are you having problems?
You know, physically, things are progressing very well. I still have a little bit of brain fog, and I still can't quite recall everything I'd like to recall as quickly as I'd like to recall it.
Okay. And this is how many days out from the event?
It was the first of the month.
All right.
So
bad news is that it may take a long time for your capacities to come back. You're past the initial stage of brain swelling, but you're not out of the woods yet. I also want to talk about, I want to give you some advice about things that functional medicine would suggest to help you get out of that brain fog. This was a big injury. Your brain was swollen. It was concussed. So the first bit is you've got to get enough sleep. And if you're having difficulty sleeping, you need to address that. My preference is with herbs, like gentle stuff, first of all, like chamomile and German chamomile and lemongrass. And if you have to go to the hard stuff, go to valerian and melatonin before you go to actual drugs. But you need to get sleep. You need to let your body teach you how much sleep it needs. And you may need 11, 12 hours for a while. That will give you your normal brain for, say, 4 or 5 hours, and then you'll run out of energy in the brain and you'll start to feel foggy again. So you kind of have to dance with this for a while. There are some things that help the brain heal, and I'm going to give you a list. So do you have something to write down?
No, I was just going to say, once my broken ribs have healed completely, then I will be sleeping. I've been sleeping better and better as the ribs have been healing better and better. So
okay.
Sleep and rest, I take at your word, and I think I'm getting enough, but okay. I know what you mean.
Just let your body teach you. If it wants a nap, take it. Okay.
Right.
DHA, which is a type of omega-3 fatty acids, it's kind of the terminal transformation. So if you eat a lot of flax or hemp, let's say you eat a gram of hemp oil, which would have the proto-DHA in it. And if you did that, you would end up with about 1% of that converting. So I generally go to the fish oils in this situation.
So if you're vegan, I'm sorry, but you can get vegan, arguably vegan DHA made from krill. And so you have to decide whether krill has a mother and whether you want to eat it. But, you know, I'll leave that between you and your ethics. But I consider krill to be like a plant. Sorry?
I'm pretty omnivorous as things go.
Good. Yeah, so DHA, you want about 1,000 milligrams a day. You're going to have to get that with supplements. You can buy high DHA products. I personally am a fan of the Nordic Naturals company. It's sourced in Norway. It's a local company. They employ local people. They're very ethical. I know the owner, and he have met him and have heard many stories about him from others. He's your original upright individual, so we can trust the process. They do all the testing. It's good stuff. They don't pay me. I don't even get free samples. So just saying, that would be the whole, you know, buy local thing. They do make a high DHA product, and you probably are looking at maybe 3 capsules to get to that 1,000. A couple of other things that you want to include in your diet or take as supplements, I'm in favor of supplements here, are phosphatidylcholine. That's phosphatidylcholine. And again, phosphatidylserine, S-E-R-I-N-E. And these are compounds that are important for the cell membrane in the brain. And these are good ways to help your brain heal more quickly. You're basically sending lots of construction material. And that is what the brain wants to do right now. The glial cells are in there getting rid of the debris and the damage. And you can supply raw materials and get things built back up again. Light exercise, also very important because it increases blood flow to the brain. And obviously you're an exerciser, so I don't have to sell that to you. But there are studies looking... at least 500 milligrams to 1,000 milligrams of each one.
A day.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're talking supplements again. This is a circumstance where you would have to eat so much lecithin or so many eggs to get there. It's time to cut to the chase and take some supplements for a little while.
Right.
I'm so glad you're better. Yeah. My best wishes for a rapid recovery.
Oh, thank you, Dawn. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Well, you take care and get well soon.
Thank you.
I have a message from a listener who says the latest evidence is not supporting baby aspirin, according to my cardiologist, Liam Bing, and many other sources for general cardiac health are calling this into question. Yes, that's true. And that's why I asked Michael about his primary, whether he had the disease, because essentially what's it's turning out to be is the older you get, the more likely you are to bleed. And the aspirin causes a lot of GI bleeds, and you end up in the hospital, and then something else happens to you, or you fall down and hit your head and bleed because you hit your head and you were on aspirin. So the baby aspirin thing is really good if the person already has cardiovascular disease, maybe has had a first heart attack or has a stent, no question about it. But just to sort of generalize that across the population, again, that's a basic factual error, the generalization error, which if you ever pick up a Statistics 101 book, they'll spend a chapter talking about the generalizability of data. Unfortunately, we don't get to do that. So I think I'll save for next week to get back to a few more emails because we are running out of time. I'll save for next week, but I'm going to give you a teaser. We're going to talk about chimeras that are being produced, combinations of the cells of humans and monkeys, and the absolute outrage that happened in France when this story broke earlier this month. We didn't talk about it at all in this country because our attention was distracted by a global pandemic and a whole bunch of other noise. What do they call it? Noise and lights loud noises signifying nothing. Yeah, we've got a lot of that going on in our media right now. The French, nah, not so much, at least in the newspapers I read. Let's go to this one from Sandra in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Sandra says, IV vitamin C for metastatic prostate cancer? Dear Dr. Don, thank you for your generous spirit and brilliant mind. Both are appreciated by your long-term listeners, me included. I have a friend who has been dealing with prostate cancer for a number of years. Recently, his scans showed lesions in several places in his pelvis and bones. You've not mentioned IV vitamin C for a while, and I was wondering what your thinking is about it now, and specifically for prostate cancer. Can you give us a deep dive into how vitamin C infusions work? Well, Sandra, I will try to give you a brief deep dive into the vitamin C issue. And let's start with the fact that vitamin C is normally thought of as an antioxidant. What that means is, let's use cosmic rays or ultraviolet radiation. So a photon comes through, gets through the atmosphere, gets through the magnetosphere, blows through your body, let's say your skin, and hits a chemical, hits something. It's going to, if it hits an oxygen, it's going to knock off an electron. And that's going to create an oxygen-free radical. This is an oxygen that is lonely, and it wants to just cuddle up and literally get in bed, get close to anything it can find that can bond with it. So this lonely molecule, or excuse me, isolated oxygen, so this lonely atom is missing what it needs, and it is going to find it. And as it does that, it steals an electron. And when it steals that electron, then suddenly it's created another compound without an electron. Now, if that compound happens to be a piece of DNA or a protein, it's going to change that molecule. If it hits DNA, it can actually damage the DNA. So we have a lot of antioxidants in our skin, and we have a lot of antioxidants in our body, and our body holds onto them as they come through in our diet and sort of layers them around the way we layer sunscreen. And I hope, by the way, you folks are using your sunscreen, because it's time to make sure you've got some in the car and make sure you have a hat too, because skin cancer, it's a thing. So getting back to the prostate cancer and the vitamin C, antioxidants are great, but when we are trying to kill cancer, we don't want the antioxidant effect. We want to exploit one of those interesting molecular facts about the body and vitamin C. If you get a very high dose of vitamin C in the bloodstream, you create what's called an oxidative burst. And so it goes from being an antioxidant to actually being a prooxidant. But it's very rapidly extinguished by the rest of the system. However, it's like a dose of high-level UV radiation to the cancer, and especially when it's paired with chemotherapy. So I do not think that IV vitamin C infusions are going to cure cancer on their own. What I do think is I think they amplify the benefit of chemotherapy, and I think there's persuasive evidence going all the way back to the late 70s, early 80s, I believe it was published in 1982, of this fact. This oxidative burst is toxic to the cancer DNA. And by the way, the cancers are growing rapidly. So their DNA is exposed, lying out there in the sun, just ready to be irradiated by an oxidative burst. The rest of your DNA, unless your cell is actively dividing, it's all folded up and kind of curved up and, you know, under an umbrella so it doesn't get damaged. You only open up your DNA and expose it to cosmic rays and ultraviolet radiation when you need to grow new tissue, which is why we get the diarrhea and the other symptoms from, like, your bone marrow. So what's growing rapidly? Your lining of your gut and your bone marrow. So what happens with chemotherapy? You drop the white count because you've basically stunned the bone marrow, and you have, you know, diarrhea because you've damaged the intestinal layer that's, you know, important for absorbing water. So if we do the combination of the vitamin C, we can use a lower dose of chemo. And if we use the standard doses of chemo, we don't get as much damage to the healthy cells because they can handle the vitamin C see, even at high levels, but the cancers can't. You know, and when I talk about IV vitamin C, you know, we had in COVID, actually, we had a talk, I think this was back in May, from a group that was promoting IV vitamin C in the early stages. And they had some, you know, serious data for it that was scientific. You can go look for that in the show archives. Here's the thing. Whenever I talk to an oncologist, they say, oh, well, that was disproven by the Mayo Clinic study, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, actually, folks, it wasn't. The Mayo Clinic study attempted to replicate the vitamin C work, but I'm sorry, they deliberately shot the study in the foot because what they did was they used oral vitamin C. You can't get blood levels with oral vitamin C. People do these vitamin C flushes all the time in the natural world. And what it does is it gives you diarrhea, cleans out your gut. Great. But you can't get a high enough blood level from the oral levels because it's a protective mechanism. The body can't absorb it, right? So out it goes. Only IV would work, and it has to be given paired with the chemo. And nobody in this country is willing to do it because they're afraid of, I don't know what. They're afraid of being sued. They're afraid of people looking at them weird. You know, all of the above? Probably. But IV vitamin C is safe. It could be used in combination with chemotherapy and in certain centers where they do sort of chemotherapy plus alternative, Cancer Treatment Centers of America, who, again, does not give me any money or freebies or anything. But I do know for a fact, because I had a friend who worked there, that they do that. They combined these therapies. But of course, probably not covered by insurance, probably for the privileged. And, you know, I really wish somebody would do a study that replicated the one that worked, prove for once and all whether it does work. But we have a medical industrial complex that's, you know, effectively run by the corporations, and even the science and the funding for the science is subject to a lot of undue influence. There's a lot of things I'd like to see looked at. And it's interesting how many things, like the aspirin, they are a thing for a while, and then we go, well, maybe not so much. Maybe we shouldn't have generalized from a single study. Well, maybe we shouldn't, but there we are. I want to take a moment to invite you to email me at my website, which is askdrdawn.com. If you think of something else or anything I've said has led you to want to ask a question, I really appreciate these questions. I want to serve the community. And the only way I know if I'm doing that or just kind of geeking out in a vacuum here is if I get the feedback from you. So, with all due respect, if you have a question, please ask it. This is me, Dr. Dawn Motyka, saying so long. Stay safe and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.